Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for coming to this spring faculty council and town hall meeting. Our agenda is shown here. We'll begin with the memory of those who have left our faculty since our last meeting. A few words on the state of the faculty. The status report on strategic planning at long last, the Ernst & Young functional review, in summary, will include some comments on the budget for next year, and we'll have two question and answer periods, one after strategic planning and then one after comments on the budget. As is our tradition, would you all rise and remain standing for a moment of silence at the conclusion of the recitation. Erwin Scott Disher, Barbara Esplin, Angus Graham, Claude Granvois, Bram Hyams, Helen Karunas, George Carpati, Leslie Kovacs, Eva Lester, J.D. McLean, Michael Moss, and Samuel Solomon. Thank you. What a year. What an absolutely incredible year. We opened with the opening of the Life Sciences Complex, the Bellini Pavilion, and the Goodman Cancer Center. And shortly thereafter, we discovered that a few thousand bankers and managers had ruined life for a billion people on the earth. A literally incredible year, and the consequences of those bankers inventing out of whole cloth, out of sea foam, an approach to economic management is something that universities will have to suffer with for the next decade or longer. So there are some clouds on the horizon. But the state of the faculty is strong. We did wonderful things, as we always do. Quebec Science, in their description of the top 10 discoveries in this province, listed a number of our wonderful investigators. Dr. Alain Brunet described a new use for propranolol in preventing post-traumatic stress. Morag Park was singled out for her work identifying 26 genes which have extraordinary capacity to predict outcome in breast cancer and turned out to be genes not present in cells of the tumor but in cells surrounding the tumor. Janusz Rak was singled out for his discovery of what he calls oncosomes, little buds off tumor cells that are responsible for metastasis. And just last Thursday, it was announced that indeed this was the discovery of the year as far as people who read Quebec Science are concerned. It goes on. Philippe Gros won a Prix du Québec, the Wilder Penfield Award, for his accomplishments in science. Brenda Milner was shortlisted for the Hertzberg Gold Medal, and we learned just yesterday that Sam Daniel of the Montreal Children's Hospital was noted in the top 40 under 40 for his accomplishments as director of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at the Children's Hospital. So just a continuation of spectacular accomplishments by this wonderful faculty in difficult times. Locally, we honor with appointment to the faculty honor list for educational excellence a group of our faculty who have contributed greatly to the educational mission. And there are eight this year: Renzo Caccieri of surgery, Kenneth Doyle of emergency medicine, Lucy Gilbert of OBGYN, Roland Grad of Family Medicine, Nancy Mayo of PNOT, Hema Patel of Pediatrics, Celia Rod of Pediatrics, and Jeffrey Weissman of Medicine. And we congratulate all of them for achieving this signal honor. The campaign for our faculty, despite the economic downturn, has continued to go quite well. We have raised $400 million of the $750 million goal that the university has set out. And within the faculty, 106 of the $130 million goal has been raised. You'll note that those ratios favor us. We are the leading faculty of the university. This is as it should be. We have the highest percentage of our goal reached, and we'll move the goal up as soon as we reach it. We need extraordinary amounts of funds to feed the engine of this faculty, and we'll keep going as far as we can through the end of the three more years that the campaign has to it. We've launched a new medicine alumni program worldwide called Medicine Alumni Global to try and recapture the interest of some of the lost souls who've left Montreal for distant climes, focusing on the United States, but also in Europe and Asia and the Middle East. And we've begun rolling out this campaign with announcements about how we want the alumni to be involved. And we'll bring that Medicine Alumni Global campaign back to the faculty in homecoming this year. So the campaign is going very well. We raised more funds in any means of looking at it than any of the other faculty, and we ought to congratulate Michelle Joannis for doing that. Congratulations. We started a new program for the orientation of our new faculty, and the definition of new included some folks who've been here for over 25 years. It's called Inside McGill, and it was designed by Yvonne Steinert and Sarkis Medaresian and their colleagues, and was held in February, I think, and was a spectacular success that I'm sure many of you heard about from our new faculty. And we plan to do this as well as introducing faculty leadership sessions for those you identify as the likely leaders of the future very shortly. So many wonderful accomplishments for the faculty, an increase in CIHR funding, activity in virtually every sector, and as we discussed extensively at the fall meeting, we are in the midst of strategic planning exercise. Maurice McGregor, at the end of the fall session, told me that he thought this was the first time in the history of the Faculty of Medicine that we had done a formal and general strategic planning exercise. I find Maurice to be right often, and so we'll assume that this is the first one. We described this in some detail in the fall, and we've just entered the third phase. So we began by the deans with our consultant thinking about this in the broadest possible strokes. We spent the fall with the Faculty Leadership Council, that's the chairs of all of the departments, coupled with the directors of the research institutes and the deans, in weekly presentations about what they considered the one, two, or three most important things for the future of this school. Or, in contrast, one or two things that were most challenging to our survival and our flourishing as a great institution of medical education. And last week, we kicked off phase three, the most important of these, in which we began the act of inventing the future of the medical school. In March, there was a wonderful op-ed published in the Globe and Mail, penned by Henry Mintzberg of the management faculty, about the mess that these managers in the country of my birth had brought to the world, and how, in fact, if they all had MBA degrees, well, the universities from which they received them ought to be pretty disappointed, because there was no evidence that they had learned anything to achieve those degrees. And he said, he quoted an unknown source in saying, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. And that is a description in part of why we are making the consideration that we are, of why we are doing strategic planning. Not that the product of our work is in any way inferior to any medical school in the world. It's not. We produce a great doc. We produce wonderful scientists who populate the world with what they do. But we ask the question, is what we are doing the best that we can possibly be doing? We spoke in the fall of the fact that we're 100 years exactly from the publication of the landmark Flexner Report by the Carnegie Foundation, which had just been founded, which changed academic medicine forever, and the fact that what was prescribed 100 years ago is recognizable in what we're doing now. And is that appropriate given the fact that this report was written when there was no penicillin, when Gutenberg was around, but the web was not, and all of the armamentarium of modern biomedical research and therapy did not exist? Is it appropriate that we teach and investigate the way we do now? And so, the objective of this exercise is literally to invent the future of the Faculty of Medicine, to explore trends in education research and the faculty life cycle, to identify best practices, to leverage our existing strengths, and to interpolate with the Faculty Leadership Council's aspirations as described in this fall extended convocation on the future of the medical school, exactly what we're going to do. And we are involving all the schools of the Faculty of Medicine, Medicine, Nursing, PT and OT, and Speech Pathology. So it's very broad. We hope in education to envision the priorities of health professions education, considering the societal needs and the changing face of healthcare, to identify new curricula, new pedagogy, and new forms of assessment. In research, to determine whether the current priorities previously validated by peer review are the appropriate priorities for the next decade, to describe the ideal organizational structure for research, and to optimize exposure of our medical students to research. We are not first in coming to this approach. In education, schools in Europe and the United States have gone to an integrated educational system in which one cannot perceive where the basic sciences end and the clinical sciences begin across 4 years or 3 years or 7 years. In research, there have been reorganizations like the one done at Mount Sinai in New York, where they've completely reorganized research into 12 translational research institutes, folding everything into those research institutes and building a new building that will open in another year to house the core of what those elements are. So we are not, of course, the first to consider these issues. And in faculty life cycle, review the critical issues to faculty recruitment, retention, and the professorial life cycle, and determine how to improve each at the Faculty of Medicine. And Mara Ludwig has begun to do this with her committee on the GFTH even before the strategic planning. We've organized this third phase for the broadest possible consultation with the rank and file in the following structure. There is a steering committee, which is comprised of the chairs of each of the three design groups, education, research, and the faculty life cycle, which the Leadership Council decided were the three areas for our intense self-reflection over the next year or so. There will be an external advisory group, a group of senior seasoned advisors, famous folks who have done major things in reinventing their educational systems or their approaches to research, who have wisdom, and as we begin to produce recommendations, they will help us review them. Now let's quickly look at these design groups. In education, the co-chairs are David Eidelman, John Orlowski, and Joyce Pickering. And look at the members of this committee, very broad representation from junior colleagues to Louis Dufresne, who is a member of the Ministry of the M3S. Students well represented and departments across our faculty. In research, the three co-chairs are Mariana Newkirk, Dave Thomas, and Remy Curion. You'll notice there has been an administrator assigned to each of these groups. Ilde Lepore is the administrator for research. And once again, representation across a very broad swath of research interest in the faculty, including graduate students. And in faculty life cycle, the co-chairs are Michelle Tremblay, Mara Ludwig, and Neil Coleman, the administrator Christine Dolden, and the members shown here, again, representing many departments within the faculty. The design groups, in turn, will appoint committees of a very expanded group of faculty and students and staff who will look at specific elements within those areas, report back to the design groups. The design groups, in turn, will report back to the steering committee. And in an iterative process, the steering committee, with the help of the external advisory group, will make recommendations back to the three design groups so that the design groups don't begin to diverge too early in the directions that they are identifying, that we can collaborate across the design groups, that we can collaborate with as large a segment of the faculty as possible to describe the future of the faculty. Here's the timeline beginning back in August of 2008 with that deanery retreat that I mentioned, the Faculty Leadership Council presentations in the fall. We have throughout this time faculty town hall meetings scheduled to hear about this. Here's today's, and we won't get to the final recommendations and implementation plan until November or December. And since the design groups have concluded that they must bring experts to the campus to conduct seminars to expand the conversation further, if it weren't until June of this next academic year when we completed these activities, well, so be it. We will take as long as we need. It would be great to finish in the next academic year, but we've been around for almost 200 years. We can afford the time to think strenuously, rigorously about our future. So, many of you were at the kickoff. Many of you have been involved in these conversations. Are there questions? Are there comments about this process of strategic planning that you'd like to engage in now? Yes, Jody.
Thank you.
The chairs were asked to nominate. Everyone was, in fact, asked to nominate, including self-nomination. We went through a cycle of trying to look at this. Here's the research design group. There are people working in many areas, though I agree with you. One could make an argument that there are some areas less well represented, but we wanted the groups to be about 12 to 15 to function properly, and we'll make certain that there is the wide consultation I described. What else? So we're at the beginning of this third phase. You'll be hearing more and more about this. A blog site will be set up. You'll be able to access all of the information that the design groups are seeing. We'll see how the experience with the blog goes. If there is too much fury and fire on the site, well, maybe that's not the approach to intelligent design, and we won't continue with that, but that's what we'd like to try and do. And if, as we go through the rest of this session, more occurs to you, we'll come back to this issue as well. I would like to spend the rest of the session talking about economics. And I promised you that there would be a renting of the curtain, that the administration would share with you all of the information about the budget of the Faculty of Medicine that we could. And we would do that by asking an external firm, E&Y in this case, to come and do an audit of the faculty, which took them longer to do because we couldn't produce some of the data that they needed. And because I think of a comment that they made in the summary of the report. One of the objectives of this was to do some benchmarking, to compare ourselves in our budgeting process, in the way we manage, and when I say we now, I mean the entire university, to other universities of our ilk. And the comment that they made about this was they were unable to do any benchmarking because they found the process of budgeting at McGill so far from the norm and so difficult to describe that there wasn't any way to compare us to other universities. So there was no benchmarking done. But we did learn a great deal about the budget, and it brought us closer to the central administration. And going forward, I think we have developed a set of tools and approaches that will put us in a better place. So the functional review. To be technical, this was not an audit. They didn't come in and look for every dollar reported by anyone, in part because we are such a complex organization with so many different institutions responsible for funds flow that they actually couldn't have accomplished that. And so this is referred to as a functional review rather than, as the accounting board standards would have it, an audit. They were to document and help us understand the main revenue inflows and expense outflows. They were to present a summary of their findings. They were to make recommendations to improve financial management at the faculty level. And they emphasize that their functional review was limited to university-controlled funds. Now, we had hoped that we would get a look at all of the individual incomes of our clinical faculty, that these would be shared with us, they would report them individually, and that the research institutes and clinical affiliates would share with us their contributions and their charges to the university. But after getting assurances from my colleagues that this would happen, it didn't happen. So the review was limited to what actually happens at the university. Now, typical sources of institutional funding for medical schools are these. First, hospitals. Through 15 years ago, in the United States and Canada, hospitals may have contributed up to about 60% of the budgets of their affiliated medical schools. With reductions in Medicare, both north and south of the border, this is no longer the case. Patient care revenues, clinical practices, practice plans that contribute in the past up to 60% or so of the total income of the medical schools with which they are affiliated. As clinical incomes have fallen relatively, the percentage of patient care revenues that are supporting medical schools have declined as well. And in general, universities contribute less than 20% to the funding of their faculties of medicine. So in North America, these are some general comments about what one might actually find. So for fiscal year 08, with the books closed last spring, this is what revenue looked like. Our operating budget, which is the money that we get from the central administration of the university, provided $76 million to us. And we'll go through each of these components individually. And that turns out to be about 27% of the total of 291, the rest made up by other funds of $215 million, which in general are restricted funds. They are the research grants that you apply for and successfully get. They are dollars donated. They are contracts won. They are gifts. And generally, all of that money can be spent by a mandate that comes with the receipt of the dollars. Here are the sources of revenue for the $291 million in total. So the budget allocation from the university represents about 26% of that $291 million total. Contracts for all manner of things, mostly research, add up to about 2.5. The federal government, also through almost entirely research funding, about a third. Gifts and bequests, 5.2. Investment income, this is on our Faculty of Medicine portion of the endowment, and things like the fact that we collect money for the life sciences complex that doesn't yet have to be paid out, that is invested and we obtain dollars from it. A big chunk, 15% almost, 10 of that 14.39% is the $16.6 million that our hospitals pay so that we can pay salaries to our faculty who work at those hospitals. So about 70% of this comes from the hospital sources as salary. The $1.72 million that many of you are interested in that come from the tuition we charge the Middle Eastern sponsors of the 300-odd residents who are here from that area of the world is also in this other category. The province pays us about 10%, and the sales of goods and services, animal services, magnetic resonance, spectroscopy, all the services that we provide are wrapped up in here, and from the U.S., about 1.5% of the total. Now, this is the 291 It's everything that comes in, and the vast majority of that is, as I said, restricted. The breakdown of expenses on that $291 million looks like this. Academic salaries are almost a third at 28.56. The benefits for both this and other salaries is 7.28%. Student-related elements, everything that we do to teach medical students, graduate students, residents, etc., is almost 8%. To support salaries, the support salaries are 10.4%, and non-salary expenses almost 46%. What are they? They appear here. So capital purchases, almost 12%. Contracts that we let for anything you would like to describe, from architecture to medical services, just over 8%. Hospital teaching costs explicitly, 4%. Building occupancy costs, a big chunk, almost a third. Transfers to partner institutions of all variety, 13.6%. And materials, supplies, and other everything, telephone, all of that stuff, another a third. So this is the restricted and the non-restricted together. And it's important to remember that every time we get a new restricted source, we get a grant from the Sackler Foundation to build the Sackler program in epigenetics and psychobiology, for example. They have a restriction. They have a mandate. They don't pay any money for bricks and mortar. So if we decide to accept those restricted funds, we have to find a source to pick up the rest of the cost. And all restricted funding sources rarely pay the freight, rarely pay 100% of the actual cost. So it's very important, it's critical, in fact, that new projects match the Faculty of Medicine priorities, because we're going to have to pay for every new restricted fund. It is a loss leader. We run on it. It is our business, but it has a cost associated with it, every single one of those funds. So, the general budget, the restricted and the non-restricted, the operating and the other. What about the operating budget support itself, the $76 million in 2008. It turns out that since the university decided to leave enrollment-based budgeting about 5 years ago, we moved to a system which is quite difficult to describe or understand. I can tell you that it's called the compact system, and it was developed so that there could be a lot of flexibility and creativity recognized. That rather than being tied just to the number of students that we teach, which is a measurable thing, that if it were decided that the Faculty of Medicine should get a bigger chunk of the funds because we were a higher priority than another faculty, well, that could be done in the context of this new invention of the compact system. But it turns out, because of the restrictions on the size of the dollars flowing into the university, that the budget, for all intents and purposes, is simply a budget allocation based on the previous year's budget with adjustments, sometimes up, sometimes down, in various categories, based on the pleas that the deans bring to the provost's office, where the final budget allocations are created. So all of you who think that we're still in a time when if you invent a new major and you attract new students, it will result in new funds flowing to the faculty, that ain't so. It doesn't happen that way anymore. And we are pretty much in a in a budget-restrictive mode, which uses this prior year allocation to start the next year. Now, when I came, I negotiated an increase in the base budget of the Faculty of Medicine of $3 million to be allocated as $1 million increments a year starting in the second year. So we've had two, and next year was supposed to be the final year of the increase in the base budget by $1 million. And I'll tell you what's going to happen to that in just a moment. The $76 million is unrestricted. If we were getting this and we had started a new medical school in that first year, you know, we would gather around large tables and decide how to divvy up the $76 million pie, and it would be terrific. But we have almost 200 years of history, and it means that the vast majority of that $76 million is not discretionary. It's not discretionary in large measure because 92% of it goes to pay salary. And whether you're a tenured faculty member, you're on the tenure track, you're not on the tenured track, or you are essentially a tenured non-academic member of the faculty, these dollars are not going anywhere. So this incredible vast majority of what we get of the operating budget is fixed. 1% is transfer operations while we're holding money in one place and we have a new recruitment and we want to transfer some funds from one account to startup for a new recruit. They'll go into this category for a while, and that leaves us with 7.2% for non-salary expenses, and we can play with that, but those things include telephone, which is a big chunk, and unless we want them shut off, we're going to continue to pay them. So the readjustment of this pie is under profound restriction, and it really is inappropriate to call this discretionary. In addition to the $76 million, we either receive or the university receives on our behalf a series of support payments directly from the hospital. So there are salary arrangements of $16.6 million, as I mentioned, in that other box. And they come from these sites, our clinical affiliates, and they pay, for example, for the 50% of the salary that is an agreed upon amount that the research institute will pay once a faculty member receives tenure, for example. And included in this are all of the other salary dollars that flow from the hospital to the university, get wrapped into the checks that you receive, and are paid to you as salary. This is not credited directly to the faculty. There are other direct supports. There's something called the MUTHC, which is the McGill University Teaching Hospital Consortium. It is Sam Benaroya's operation that runs the recruitment of faculty both in the hospitals and in the research institutes to McGill. And so because we run this service, the hospitals have agreed to give us some bucks for it, and there are payments for the running of the simulation center that total almost $600,000. The RUIS, that is our largely unfunded regional network of healthcare that covers 63% of the landmass of Quebec, brings in from the hospitals about $300,000 a year, and our biomedical ethics program, $100,000 a year, and that does not include the individual consultations that biomedical ethics performs. So some money that comes from our hospital to us Now some money that goes from us, for the most part, to the hospitals. The incredibly wonderful and complex overhead indirect cost matrix. Let's start with the federal, these four lines. And depending on where the faculty member is physically or administratively located, determines historically what happens to the indirect costs. So research conducted in buildings owned by McGill, there's a division of the indirect costs in which 25% come to the faculty and 75% are retained by the central administration for heat, light, electricity, and the non-delivery of FedEx packages at the Life Sciences Center. Those of you who don't work there, there's a problem with FedEx. Research conducted at the hospitals, the faculty receives nothing. I find that interesting. Inappropriate, but interesting. The central administration keeps 20% and the hospital keeps 80%. Research conducted at the MNI, central administration takes 40 and the MNI takes 60. Now, you know, these things just didn't arise, and so there are checks and balances, there are incomes and offsets that are responsible for why these numbers are different. But it would be a reasonable question. Why does it look the way it looks? And why does the Faculty of Medicine get only 25% from this single category? Now, if you move from federal dollars to overhead from contracts, you see that it's a little more complex. A third and two-thirds, 30-10-60, 14-28, 58 hike, oncology, clinical trials, 35-15-50. Once again, historical imperatives, but it seems quite complicated. We still don't know all of the contracts that the faculty actually receives in this category, and this is an area where we might spend some time in the next year or so figuring out appropriate distributions based on modern needs. And it's a perfect kind of thing that arises from the strategic planning exercise, so that if the research is reorganized in a particular way, certainly the overhead ought to be readjusted to reflect that reorganization. What is not listed here is funding from the province. And that is because it goes to central administration. And central administration claims that we get an appropriate portion of that in the $76 million general operating account, but there is no further accounting of those dollars. And as we gear up the funding applications to the FRSQ, we have to think about whether we could make some of that indirect cost more explicit and have another source of income from it. Any questions about the distribution of overhead? Yes, sir. Joanne, where's Joanne? The total overhead? Yeah, we've never seen those figures. So the answer for those of you in the back, we haven't seen the dollars associated with those numbers. We will get them shortly. Right, where it's distributed. Bernard?
The central administration gets its money from the province based on the number of students, and the formula is very transparent. Has the faculty figured out whether we are getting our fair share? Do the $76 million represent, in fact, the work that our faculty is doing, or less or more?
So we think it represents less. In the spring faculty council meeting of last year, Tony Massey was with us, and he admitted that the Faculty of Medicine was allowing a supplement of less successful faculties on campus, and I believe that confirms that we are not getting our fair share of the MELS money.
Because if you look at the total budget, which was just presented, as I'm sure you've seen at Senate, the amount of money that we get for indirect cost and the amount of money we get from MELS has very clear formulas.
Yes.
There is no reason for us to not ask for what we should be getting.
Except for the notion that was advanced when we went from endowment-based to complement-based budgeting, that would give the university the latitude to consider other things than the gris in distributing those funds. That is a very, I think, important and slightly subtle issue. The central administration says we are paying for everything that we have to pay for at the tune of this year a $10 million deficit, last year a $17 million deficit, next year a $5 million deficit. And we're doing that by collecting all the funds we collect from MELS, from philanthropy, from other gifts, from contracts. You want to track the dollars that are the indirect dollars from the FRSQ. Well, you don't have to worry about that because we are giving you what we give you to make you whole in the budget that we publish every year. But we may not be giving you the dollars that you earned. We may be giving you the dollars that we can. So that is an issue. David.
Building on that idea, I remember asking Tony Massey this after the session, right? You asked your question. If the faculty generates a surplus to the other faculty, then why are we restricted so severely in the size of the faculty? It makes sense that if one has one, then one could make a calculation, the value added on average for each faculty hire, and we can make a rational basis.
Outstanding. Because, as Bernard Robert would tell us, the number of faculty members in our complement is based on the MELS funding.
Yeah.
Right. So there is an inconsistency between the description of the number of faculty based on the gris, especially given the fact that we bring in well over 63-65%, where's Mariana, of the total funding brought into the university. Much of that is in salary awards. Those salary awards reduce teaching time, and therefore you cannot make the equation that the MELS, which is largely for funding teaching, is the basis for the complement, because we need to have a fudge factor for the fact that we pull from the available time of the faculty. So we need to talk about that as well. So The simple case is we make enough money to let the dollars flow downhill a bit. So why not allow us to do that in larger measure by having more faculty? On the other hand, those faculty will obtain tenure for the most part, and that will be an unfunded salary liability at some point for some duration of time in the future, because those faculty will be unfunded but salaried at some point. And while the current complement and calculations attempt to compensate for that fact, we got into trouble when the retirement rate dropped below the model that had been used to create all this, and now we wind up with what was a $27 million university-wide deficit. So, yes, no better at all. Let me finish this presentation, and then we can come back to this conversation. So the matrix that I just showed you results in research overhead from McGill to the hospitals of almost $7 million a year. This is by contract, 3.8 to the MUHC, 1.6 to the Jewish, 1.05 to Douglas, etc. Okay, so these are funds that are flowing to the hospitals from the overhead that we get from research grants. And overhead from research contracts a much smaller number, 0.6 million, which is divided, into two hospitals. There are other payments. There are teaching transfers from the Faculty of Medicine to the hospitals that total almost $5 million. This is a pass-through. These are dollars that MELS give each of the four medical faculties, give to the university of the four medical faculties, to pay for resident and student education in the clinical environment. Until next fiscal year, this was the distribution based on very old data. We looked at the data once again and prorated the distribution based on the number of medical students and residents who go to each of the hospitals and training sites. It changed quite a bit, and therefore the dollars next year will change quite a bit, and we've notified each of the hospitals about the changes that are taking place in them. So, those are the dollar figures that I wanted to share with you so that you would have a general understanding of where it comes from and where it goes. There are departmental level descriptions that Ernst & Young has provided that we are collating, will be given to each of the departmental chairs, and will be shared with you. There's not going to be, I hope, in a year's time, the claim by any member of our faculty that, oh, the budget is just a black box. Levin and the deans distribute it however they like, and reward by some schedule that only they know, because you'll see everything. You'll see all the dollars. And you will see in this data, in these data, that there is a vast variation in the budgets of the departments. And the variations are based on, once again, historical imperatives that go back a long way, the number of people in the departments, the number of faculty, all kinds of things. But there are discrepancies that are inexplicable, and this is the kind of thing we're going to have to work on over the next 5 years. So what did Ernst & Young tell us after doing all of this work? Remembering that the functional review was limited to university-controlled activities and didn't include hospitals or patient care revenue, that McGill uses mainly something called fund accounting, so that the analysis of individual funds is crucial to understanding finances. So in Economics 101. What is fund accounting? Fund accounting is kind of a not-for-profit standard. Unlike a corporate entity, a for-profit entity, which has one balance sheet where they look at the profits and the losses and they come up with an annual statement, we have many individual balance sheets because of all of those mandates that say we have to spend 70% on this and 30% on that and 0.5% on something else. Funds can rarely be transferred outside of most of these accounts. There are 15,000 fund accounts at the university, and we have 10,000 of them. And when Ernst & Young discovered that there were 10,000 accounts that they had to audit, there was a brief moment spent in the loo, and they have actually closed the unit that did this review because it just didn't work on an accounting basis. The fact that there are 10,000 accounts and the fact that these 10,000 accounts have to be managed individually begins to describe some of the complexity that Joanne Miller's group has to deal with and is one of the reasons why things have been so murky for such a long period of time. So what did they say? Well, there should be improved financial reporting and transparency. And we will have transparency. I've broken some notions that you probably were carrying around, and more will be broken when we get down to the individual departmental stuff. And I think as well there will be improved financial reporting, in part because the university has adopted new approaches and hired new people to do this, and in part because we've established a new relationship with the central administration that will make the obtaining of critical data easier going forward. They also made some unrealistic recommendations that had been tied to the original expectation that we would have all the data and that we could do something that I explained to you was called mission-based budgeting, in which we looked at the productivity of each individual member of the faculty, and we made adjustments to the departments based on that with an annual departmental budget that was a roll-up of the whole thing. But our ability to describe who occupies particular space and the dollars that they receive for that space, either directly in research or indirectly as overhead dollars, are not precise enough. We are unable to start with a clean budget slate, and we can only estimate individual clinical income, which by inspection by the chairs of the clinical departments turned out not to reflect many realities. So the idea of giving all of us a report card and assigning space and resources based on that is not going to be available in this faculty for some time. We may get there. We may decide to go there, but it's going to take a lot of work and some dollars. They also recommended that we create an advisory budget committee. I thought this was a great idea. They recommended that we put this board together of 7 members that would be elected by the faculty. There would be some department chairs, some deans, and some faculty members. We'll give this commission support from the executive director and the entire administration so that they can understand these dollars. At the beginning, we may have some consultants meeting with the group so that it can quickly come up to speed. And we'll ask on an annual basis that this budget advisory comprised of you help me to set the annual budget going forward, remembering that currently we get the budget from the central administration. And this would be a distribution of the pie that would be based presumably on the priorities that arise from the strategic planning exercise, and the priority pool dollars, which we'll get to in just a second. So I thought this was a very good idea, and we're going to work with the Faculty Leadership Council to figure out exactly how to do it. Maybe it'll be 11 members. It doesn't really matter. But we will have an advisory budget committee of faculty. I'm going to leave the Ernst & Young review. You will talk departmentally about this in much more detail. And I want now to talk about the compact for the next year and the budget reductions that you had promised in the principal's first letter and then described in more detail in the principal's letter received either the end of last week or the beginning of this. This is a draft. This is a proposal by the central administration for us that will be worked on by us in meetings between me and the provost, and we'll see how it comes out. But this is what has been proposed thus far. You read Heather's letter. She said we will use the economic challenges as an occasion to make decisions that have yet to be made or that are being implemented too slowly in order to make McGill yet more innovative, quality-driven, and accountable. So, like any great academic president, she is saying that we will use the challenge of this crisis to figure out how to make ourselves better, stronger, faster, leaner, to focus on our priorities rather than focusing on everything. And the two areas where we are struck the most by the economic downturn around us, by what those bankers wrought, are in the endowment and the interest from the endowment, which is affected doubly. The endowment is down by 23% from its height, and the interest rate on the funds in that endowment for some portions of this year essentially went to zero. The endowment usually declares a 5% interest rate. That's the imputed rate. It has nothing to do with the actual amount of money made on those dollars, which were close to $900 million and are now down around $700 million. And so the amount is down, the interest rate is down, and the Board of Governors last week decided that they would declare the interest rate on the endowment at 4.25%, instead of 5%, a 15% reduction, and that the central administration would take on the problem of paying for all of the endowed professorships, scholarships, etc., that are based on the 5%, making up that differential, but the individual faculties would have to figure out how to make up everything else. And that's part of the problem that we share collectively. So in a letter that I received from Tony Massey, this was the proposed budget cut for the Faculty of Medicine. Our permanent budget as of February 2000, the provost recommends that we consider cuts organized as shown here, so that we reduce travel and hospitality by 15%, or $116,000, This is particularly difficult because you generally go to conferences where you present your work, which is a critical function, and I generally go to conferences where I try and raise money to support your work. And there isn't much more. I mean, yes, there are some boondoggles during the year, but it's not that much, and so this is difficult. Purchasing controls. Instead of purchasing the AirBook, if you're using a Mac, you purchase a clunkier one that the university will decide we can buy centrally, and in so doing will create a budgetary savings. Attrition savings of $75,000. That means, in essence, they want us to not rehire one or two people who leave this year. And I don't think we should do that. It's not brave of me to say that. I think we just shouldn't, in this first year of budget exigency, let anybody go and not replace them. So we ought to put that $75,000 in one of these other categories. The reassessment of teaching loads and support is something that was worked out by the Provost Task Force. Our representative was Mara Ludwig. And what this means may work at the other faculties, but doesn't work for us. And it means that we should, in essence, put more teaching load on the tenured faculty and not pay the non-tenured faculty for doing that teaching. And since we have the vast majority of our faculty in the GFTH category, the non-tenured category, this doesn't work as it's imagined for the rest of the university. And that's the biggest category, and we're going to have to figure out where to come up with almost $500,000. So they propose that the portion of the funding to cut the deficit, our contribution, is $713,000. And then we take $266,000, that makes $979,000, about $1 million, and we make that our contribution to the priority pool, which is a concept that universities are using everywhere to refocus their activities and energies from the average level of priority to high priority. So we're contributing $266,000. All the other faculties will contribute their appropriate portions to the priority pool. It will be a total, as of next year, of $6 million because we contributed $3 million in this fiscal year. Those funds will be distributed to the faculties based on our ability to bid, based on our ability to convince the central administration that we are a higher priority than faculty X or faculty Y. And we have these ideas and we want to fund them. What that means is while we are perhaps getting an unfair share of dollars removed chronically and in this budget reduction, if we make the case that the life sciences, that the work that we do, should be supported to a greater extent than the work that somebody else does, we are not necessarily restricted to regaining that $266,000. We could gain $500,000 or $1 million or $3 million. And in so doing, make up for us the fact that we are so restricted, as Dr. Eidelman pointed out, in our recruiting at the moment. Of course, the 266 is also at risk. And so if we don't do the bidding well, we could lose that to another faculty. So this is the structure that the university has suggested we think about, and we will come back to them with where we would like to make these cuts. But that we have to make 1.5% is clear. We're going to have to come up with this, and we're going to have to come up with another small piece that we find particularly, potentially, I should say, disturbing. This is a bit complex, but let's cut it to the simple elements. These are along the horizontal here, these columns describe unrestricted funds in the 1B to 1F category. Doesn't matter. They're monies that we get that are unrestricted, and they are distributed for a variety of purposes. The largest one is this, which has an income of $3.5 million this year. And that is carryovers. All of you and the deanery try and squirrel away some bucks so that if the grant isn't refunded in the first cycle, you won't have to shut down. And it turns out that we carry forward a lot of dollars. This goes from year to year. And what the university has proposed for us and some of the other faculties is that a portion of our unrestricted funds be taxed at 1.5% for a small, very small number, $67,000. We wouldn't notice it, but the biggest chunk comes from these carry-forwards. And so, if each of you went out tomorrow morning and spent all of the funds in all of your unspent balances, we would have a problem. We would have a problem in finding that 1.5%, but we would have a bigger problem, and that would turn out to be $3.5 million in additional deficit for the university. Because those were dollars that were credited sometime earlier, and we didn't budget them for this year. So don't do that. We'll talk about this with the provost as well. And when the Faculty Leadership Council heard about this last Thursday, they concluded that we should do everything we can not to do this 1.5%, because this could become a difficult place for us to play in the future. And we will do precisely that. We will try and stay away from these dollars. So, you now know about the budget of the Faculty of Medicine, maybe in more detail than you wanted. Probably not. Most of our funds are non-discretionary, and I think we are managing those funds pretty well. We will decide how to distribute things based on our priorities, the ones that we decide together in the strategic planning process and in forums like this. And we will try and make the hit of this budget reduction due to external conditions, which meant that the university will collect fewer dollars in this coming fiscal year than it anticipated. We will try and make the hit as painless as possible. And I think we should stop with data now and continue the conversation if you would like. Yes.
I have a small question. For example, departments like anatomy, biology, which have a very high rise of students from science. So what's happening with this money? Is that money that reverts the big science department to teach in the science faculty?
It is claimed that the faculty of science, not the faculty of medicine, is receiving a payment for that huge number of students. This is a very interesting issue. It turns out that the Faculty of Medicine teaches 62% of the students in the basic science majors. And I would guess, especially because of the increases in the numbers of those students, since we went to the compact system, right, that we are not getting the appropriate share of those dollars. But we don't actually know that. And it's hard to know in particular because we're no longer on the enrollment-based budget. We do know how many students have graced our classrooms. So 1994 was the last year in which we reached a peak in faculty number. From 1994, it slid down. It is on its way back up. And if you ask the question, how many students are we teaching now for how many faculty, the faculty has increased 5% from the nadir, which occurred in 1999, and the students have increased 35%. So if you want to make the case that some of our research faculty have been diverted in their research efforts because they have to teach 35% more students now than they were teaching in 1999, the evidence is there. Further, if you ask the question about relative success with the tri-councils, if you go back to 1994 and look at the accretion of faculty members in the six major research faculties in the country, it turns out that we are down 90 faculty members, full-time faculty members, from the average number across those six schools in Canada, 85 when you just look at the University of Toronto. So those schools hired 100 more full-time faculty members between 1994 and the present, which is one of the reasons that they've got a bigger share relatively of the Tri-Council dollars than we have. So I would like to make the argument, Mara would like, has made the argument to Central, that at minimum our complement is 100 people too small on the basis of those figures. David. Is that right? Bernard, is that about right?
We have a table for every level, for undergraduate, graduate, for every course that students take at the undergraduate level. We can figure out there are too many problems. In fact, what the faculty are teaching is what the teaching that the faculty is generating in dollars for the university.
Yeah, we should do that, understanding that that alone is not what we will demand. Right. Yeah. I mean, compared to what we get from Mills. Yeah. I don't know. It's a good question. Yes. I think we'll be fine. I don't want you to leave thinking that that the best days are behind us. We opened up this magnificent building. We're going to build more buildings. We're going to hire more people. And we just may have to take a little bit longer to get there. But these next couple of years, because it is estimated that the impact of the downturn on universities will be worse in the 11-year than it is in the 10-year, we will see if that is true. We'll have a couple of tough years in which we're all going to have to work together to make sure that we support each other and come out of this with the great science and the great students that we always have. And I'm sure we will do that. And I would very much like to join you now for a drink outside. Thank you very much.